Great. As you know, we're carrying on our series of what we missed in Ecclesiastes. I'm not really going to do a recap on what I've done the last couple of weeks. There is those talks on the podcast and on our website as well. So please take a listen to those if you want an introduction into Ecclesiastes and what we talked about last week. I will be showing a film now, which is what I talked about a couple of weeks ago, well, last weekend. And this is the clip that I made reference to last Sunday. It's taken from a film called The Dead Poets Society, which is a 1989 coming-of-age drama set in 1959 in an elite American school. And Robin Williams plays a English teacher who's new to the school. His name is John Keating, and he's got an unusual approach, an unorthodox approach to teaching his pubescent boys what poetry is. And this is the first time, the occasion that he meets these young lads and his particular style of what he wants to introduce to them in terms of poetry. So take a listen to this.
Fitz, the opening note, page 542. Read the first stanza of the poem you find there.
So the versions to make much of time?
Yes.
Come on.
Somewhat appropriate, isn't it?
Gather ye rosebuds while ye may, old time is still a-flying, and this same flower that smiles today, tomorrow will be dying.
Thank you, Mr. Pitts.
Gather ye rosebuds while ye may. The Latin term for that sentiment is carpe diem. Who knows what that means? Carpe diem, that's seize the day.
Very good, Mr. Meeks.
Meeks,
another unusual name.
Seize the day. Gather ye rosebuds while ye may.
Why does the writer use these lines?
Because he's in a hurry.
No.
Ding!
I took mine anyway. Because we are food for worms, lads. Because believe it or not, each and every one of us in this room is one day going to stop breathing, turn cold, and die. I'd like you to step forward over here. Peruse some of the faces from the past. You've walked past them many times. I don't think you really looked at them. They're not that different from you, are they?
Same haircuts.
Full of hormones, just like you. Invincible, just like you feel. The world is their oyster. They believe they're destined for great things, just like many of you. Their eyes are full of hope. Just like you. Did they wait until it was too late to make from their lives even one iota of what they were capable? Because you see, gentlemen, these boys are now fertilizing daffodils. But if you listen real close, you can hear them whisper their legacy to you. Go on, lean in. Listen. You hear it?
So we are looking at what it means, in part anyway, to seize the day, because that is part of the rhetoric, I suppose, of this, not the author of the book of Ecclesiastes, but the protagonist, the preacher, the sage. He is called Qohelet. He's basically the purveyor of all life and the investigator of all life and all the experiences of life. And we hear his thoughts about what it means to explore and investigate life for meaning. And he goes into a whole series of experiences to see whether he can find meaning in all those experiences. And despite seizing the day of work and pleasure and building and creativity and all the things that he explores and experiences in life, he finds everything absurd vapour. And last week, he came to this unsettling conclusion that all the things in life that he tried to grasp and seize were ultimately not in his in control. He was unable to do anything with them despite his resources to be able to experience all these things. Life was vapor. It was mist. It was uncontrollable. He couldn't grasp it or seize it. And his judgment of life was a thing that led him to angst and despair. The other part of that uncontrollability of life is the sense that he comes to now in the second stage of this, where he says, right from the very beginning, these words: what do people gain from all their labours at which they toil under the sun? Now, we're going to explore this morning some of the things that actually Eleanor has helpfully touched on in terms of change, and the way in which we recognise the change that either exists or doesn't exist in the world. But when he, our sage, our preacher, our purveyor of life, comes to touch everything that's within his grasp, he realises that he gets no reward for them, no gain or surplus, no benefit or no advantage from what he does. In actual fact, humans follow the same course, he says, that nature does as well. Because he says this, and this is a verse we've seen already: the wind blows to the south and goes round to the north. Round and round goes the wind, and on its circuit the wind returns. He goes on to say then, all streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, where they flow again. So again and again, the streams run into the sea, but it's never full. The wind just blows and blows and blows. So on this occasion, he's lamenting the lack of change within nature as he sees it. And he says, that's what our lives are like. There's no change. Things just go on a repetitive, boring circuit and cycle. And he says, for all our work, for all our sweat and toil, we produce nothing. And therefore, it's absurd meaninglessness. So the word gain he uses is a sort of financial term. It sort of equals profit. So think of life as a ledger. A ledger is a really old-fashioned word to describe a ledger book that accountants used to use to total up the profit and losses. Think of an Excel document or a way in which you work out your own finances at home or at work. And life is a ledger of debits and credits, of profit and losses. And that applies to our work, our health, our family, our leisure pursuits, everything that we do. We total up all the debits and credits, all the good things and bad things, all the things that we do achieve and all the things that we don't achieve. And in the end, Coelette says, we don't get any profit at all. We actually get debt. Out of all those things that we add up in my column, of my ledger, of my Excel sheet, there is nothing left that I have as an advantage in life. I'm left with debt. No gain, no profit, no surplus. And he then presents a whole portfolio of evidence in all the areas of his life which he sees no gain or profit. We've looked at already what he says about work. What gain has the worker from his or her toil? In the morning sow your seed, and in the evening withhold not your hand, for you do not know which will prosper, this or that, or whether both alike will be good. You wake up in the morning, you think, am I going to produce anything this morning? Am I going to do anything good with my work? Am I going to achieve a task which I wanted to do or my employers wanted me to do? Who knows? At the end of the day, I'll be positive or negative about the day of my work. And that may be your thoughts for tomorrow morning. So there we go. I encourage you with that. Then he looks at pleasure. Whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil, and this was my reward for my toil. He goes on to say, despite all this pleasure, he finds no gain or profit. What about these verses about the investment of time and money? I hated all the things that I had toiled for under the sun, because I must leave them to one who comes after me. I work so hard to build up a business And then someone comes along and takes it from me and then just ruins it because he's a fool, he goes on to say. And who knows whether that person will be wise or foolish. The next person that steps into my shoes may just throw it all away. The business might go bust because he doesn't know how to run it. Yet they will have control over the fruit of my toil into which I have poured my effort and skill under the sun. This too is meaninglessness. So he's painting this picture of all these things in his life which he struggles to come to terms with in terms of producing fruit. What about wisdom and knowledge? For the wise, like the fool, will not be long remembered. The days have already come when both have been forgotten. Like the fool, the wise must die. What's the point of being righteous or wise when we have the same end? Food for worms, boys. As the foolish. And then finally, the area of justice. Here's something else I saw on the earth. Where people should be treated right, they're treated wrong. Where people should be treated fairly, they are treated unfairly. In this meaningless life of mine, I have seen both of these. The righteous perishing in their righteousness and the wicked living long in their wickedness. So even the arc of the world, which we hope will bend towards justice, does not produce justice, despite how wise and righteous you are. This is his very depressing lament. He then goes on to say, there's no gain over the animals. You look at the animals, we share the same fate as animals. We are food for worms. We are and will be dust like the animals. So a couple of years ago, when was it, last September? We went to Albania and we decided, once we got up to Tirana, the capital city, at the end of our stay, we decided that we would take a fairly long bus journey outside the city to go up a cable car up to this mountain. And it was quite a long cable car journey, spectacular, up to a point where we actually couldn't see anything. And the city and the mountainous regions that we were looking down on were really just a blur through the fog. And then once we got to the top of the cable car, we had another 5 kilometre hike to the top, which I'd seen pictures of, and the view from the top was absolutely stunning. This was the point where we were just reaching about probably another 1.5 kilometres up to the top. So you could see the fog was closing in already. Once we got to the top, the sun was sort of shining, but it was just peeking through the clouds. We tried to get through these bushes and bracken to try and find this place where we could have our lunch and have this idyllic view over this massive landscape. And there was just nothing but fog. So we'd spent sort of like 3-4 hours trying to get there, get to this peak, and then find just fog in front of us. This, I sense, is how Coelette is feeling when he engages in pleasure and work and wisdom and knowledge and study and all the things that he does, probably like us, when we work and we graft and we walk and we go on a cable car and we travel and then we rise to the peak, we look over all that we've made and we hope to see, and it's just fog, mist, vapour, nothing there at all to see in terms of reward for our good stuff that we've done. And it is Albert Camus that uses the idea of the Greek tragedy Sisyphus, who was a Greek god who was condemned by the gods for trying to cheat death. And his punishment was to push a boulder up a hill. Once he got to the top, he saw it roll down to the bottom, and he would spend all eternity pushing this boulder up a hill. And that was Camus' understanding of the futility and the absurdity of life as he saw it in the 1940s and 50s. And that may feel like your work at the moment. The stuff that you're doing is pushing a boulder up a hill, only for it to roll and tumble back down, and you seem to be doing it round and round and round. No gain for our work. And this seems to be sharing the ancient wisdom of how Coelette feels as well. So it resonates both with a philosopher like Camus, but also in our normal everyday existence. He goes on to say, Coelette here, all things are tiresome They are more tiresome than anything else can say, but our eyes have never seen enough of anything. Our ears never hear enough. He is completely unsatisfied from what he hears and sees. Everyone's toil is for their mouth, yet their appetite is never satisfied. So here we have this massive gap between what we desire and what we long for and actually what happens. That is the crux of the human dilemma. That is my dilemma, that is your dilemma. I know it is because you're human. I don't need to know you to realise that this is the human dilemma. To have hopes and dreams of something that is done in life that involves our work and labour, and yet at the same time there's this massive disconnect and void between actually what happens. And that was Camus' despair. That is the human condition. And that is partly to what we think internally, but also is what society, what modern society makes us strive and grasp for. The Protestant work ethic. That we would do work and we will get reward. Our capitalist society is based on doing stuff and getting stuff back. You know, the exchange of money. You pay for stuff, you get something back. The idea that work should be like that, or anything in our life. If we only just put enough effort in, then we'll get something back from it. If you've been watching the World Cup, if you're interested in that kind of thing, there's been lots of managers on that lament the fact that their players worked very hard during the game and yet they lost 1-0. They didn't have reward for their effort. And that psyche is part of all of us. And we quickly learn, therefore, that the race is not to the swift, as we talked about. That we won't get in what our investment is worthy of. And even the meek don't seem to inherit the earth. So what do we do when our effort and our toil produces nothing? How do we react when we do not get any gain from our toil? For a couple of minutes, I want you to just talk about on your tables. We're not going to have any feedback, but try and discuss that question. What do we do when there is a disconnect, a mismatch between our work and our hopes and expectations in all areas of our life and getting nothing in return? What do we do with the disappointment of that? Okay, a couple of minutes. Hopefully that is just the beginning of a conversation about disappointment. Last week, I introduced a German sociologist called Harmut Rosa, and he understood, or tried to get us to understand, how we respond as a society to life's uncontrollability. Now that's one part of what I'm talking about this morning, but actually the other part is, how do we cope with the pressure to gain? Society's pressure and our internal ledger, which wants us to achieve more, to gain more time, to gain more stuff, to have a bigger, better, bolder life, to always producing more. And he said, modern existence is through the lens of the triple A's. Can anybody remember what those three A's were?
Availability.
Available, yes. We seize what is available to us.
Accessible,
yes. It's available and it's accessible, so we can seize it, take it, grasp it.
Attainable,
yes. Yeah, brilliant. So the triple A is particularly about modern life. It's available, it's accessible, and it's achievable, it's attainable. And through that lens, we are conditioned to seize and to grasp. It feeds into our internal ledger, what always wants our lives to be in a surplus, with a gain and with an advantage. And we always want this reward for our labour. Because let's not kid ourselves, this is not a bad thing. We are built like this as humans. We all want to, when we get up in the morning, to think, I'm going to achieve stuff, I'm going to do stuff, and at the end of the day, think, I've actually done stuff. I've written this article, I've read something, I've met up with some friends, I've produced something, I've had a good conversation, I've produced a piece of work, I've learnt stuff. At the end of the day, we all want to look back and think, yeah, Today has been a good day because I've done stuff. I've been efficient, I've been helpful. So we like the mantra, seize the day, make our lives extraordinary, because we want to feel as if we've done stuff that is extraordinary each day, and we've had a plus, we've had an advantage, we've had a surplus. But we don't need Coelette's ancient wisdom and Camus' philosophy to realise the frustration and disappointment when at the end of the day we look back and think, I ain't done anything. It's just been mindless, boring series of meetings. I haven't produced stuff. I've got stuck in a rut of doing stuff. I've been distracted with doing things. And it's just been the same old. And here's the rub, and the sobering rub is this. There are some truths about our capitalistic digital age which propels us not only from our internal ledger, but outside of us to strive and to seize what we can gain. See, production and achievement, and we've talked about this many times before, production and achievement are the cult and the currency of our lives. They're the cult and the currency of our lives. We are, and I don't exaggerate with this, I think we are the most monitored and measured bunch of humans in all of history. Everything that we do is monitored and measured. Our output, our productivity, just normal life, everything that we do somehow, because we've got a phone and we work with computers, we are monitored and measured in a way that no other generation has. From the websites that we visit, from the social media we engage with, from the emails we send, with the calories we burn, with the footsteps we take, our heart rate. You know, we've noticed that you've got something in your basket which you haven't bought yet. Yes, I know, because you've been monitoring what I have and what I haven't spent. I get a ping of an email to say, yes, go ahead and buy it. You must have got distracted. Surely you want it still. And so we get into the habit of wanting to gain more. I'm going to call it a Fitbit culture. A Fitbit culture which monitors and measures us. The algorithms learn to predict every aspect of our lives, and they read our hard data. One of the really boring things about fundraising, if you're in this game, and I learnt this a long time ago when we were fundraising for the Gap Project and various things, is that funders want outputs and outcomes. And I had to learn the difference between what is an output and what is an outcome. And the output is what you do, all the stuff that you produce, and the outcome is what happens when you do that stuff. And I had to measure it all and produce reports to the funders, and that's all very well and that's right and proper. But sometimes I feel as if there is a world, a societal world, which is still wanting us to do lots and lots of outputs, and therefore will measure from our output the outcomes of how good it is. And that is a pressure that we all feel in some shape or form. We are constantly read and measured, and therefore, above all things, we learn to value, more than anything probably, what we produce and how efficient we are. A Fitbit advertising that I saw the other day says, make every move a healthy one. Wow, every move. That's tough going. So if control, as I said last week, is a measure of the good life, gain or surplus is a measure of our worth. What we produce measures how good we are, our status. The Fitbit culture nurtures a Fitbit mentality which says our gains and our surplus and our advantage becomes our justifying story. It justifies who we are and our status. So we don't just get a reward, it justifies us in our personhood and our identity. What we do becomes a virtue. And what our children do becomes a virtue, if they're good, of course. You may have heard the phrase sharenting. Sharenting is a phrase I think was coined in 2019. It was the propensity of parents to share all their children's moments and achievements on social media. So Abby picks a nose for the first time. Great, we'll get it on social media. Little Keith, he wears blue for the first time. Well done, mate. Yes, let's get a round of applause for little Keith that's worn blue for the first time. Audrey gets a nappy off and swings it round her head for the first time. Let's get it on social media. Sharing-ting. Because, of course, all their achievements and moments are ours. And we share in those, their achievements. Of course, when they're not so good, we don't put that online, of course. Dare we say. So their story justifies us and our story because it shows us what good parents we are. Jesus said these words, What should it profit a man who gains the whole world but loses his soul? So what I want to do now for the last bit is to look at four ways in which we lose our soul. Now, I'm not talking about our eternal damnation. I'm talking about our identity, our work, our personhood, what we do when we are pursuing gain. So four quick things and then four responses to that at the same time. So what do we lose in this pursuit of gain and advantage? First of all, Harmut Rosa says that we get burnt out. We're becoming exhausted by being constantly monitored and measured, by living according to the triple A's. It creates in us a toxic expectation from our internal accountant to the external ledger of social media and the Fitbit culture. Anyone can be exceptional, we heard, so therefore everybody should be exceptional. We should all be extraordinary. And to be honest, it's exhausting. You see, there are minutes in the day when I'm not exceptional. You know, just a few short seconds in the day when I'm not doing anything extraordinary. No, there are days on end, months on end, of course. It's tiring to make every step a healthy one. How can we even maintain that kind of mantra that society tells us we should be like that? So we can't be those kind of humans, and it burns us out, first one. Secondly, in a Fitbit world, in our personal life, in our work situations, even in church, a Fitbit culture tempts us to treat people according to their productivity and their output. We measure their worth, so not only is our worth measured, but we measure their worth, what their contribution is to the workplace, to the church. So whether you can volunteer, whether you can give money, whether you'll use your gifts, you are only worth something when you are doing stuff. Now, we all are working in various different environments, which are more forgiving and less dominating than that. But most of us have probably been in work situations where we felt as if we're undervalued and all we're doing is producing stuff for our employer or the vision of the business or whatever, and our innate worth and status is undervalued. That's what happens in this culture and world. Thirdly, this leads to competition. It's a competition for worth and status according to what we can gain and produce. So the more we gain and the more we produce, we are competing with other people. It develops a scarcity mentality. Someone else's gain is our loss. It's called resource scarcity scapegoating. It's what we saw again at the film The Old Oak on Friday in regards to the refugee crisis. You see, for many people, the refugees are not just a threat to people's and communities' safety and well-being. It is a threat to what they have. So their homes, our school places, our dentists and NHS system, it's creaking under all these people that are here in this country. That is the scarcity mentality. Their presence is our loss. That's the narrative. And this is what happens when we are propelled by this ledger mentality of production and gain. Someone else's gain is our loss. And then fourthly, there is a human and environmental cost to most of our gains. All that we gain in life, or at least indeed a lot of it on a daily basis, and this is not just about getting access to cheap clothing, fast technology, cheaper food. There's a debit impact on the environment, of course, we know that. And, of course, on overseas workforce that produce our stuff, our gain. So there is always a ripple effect somewhere for our gain on someone else and something else, which is the Earth. Think about AI for a minute. AI, ChatGPT, I love AI. That's just something we all go about in our house. It feeds into the cult and the currency of productivity. Now, this isn't a deconstruction of AI. All I'm saying is, from what I see, the mantra that we gain time from AI could be true, but unpacking it, what does it mean in terms of what we actually gain? Is it that we just become more efficient and our workplaces and our employers expect us to do more stuff, produce more in the same allotted time that we had 10, 15 years ago? We just should be more efficient because AI helps us be more efficient. What about the climate cost, of course? And we know that, the vast data fields of electricity. Do you know the difference between a regular Google search and the same search into ChatGPT? So if I were to say or ask a question, what are Scotland's chances of winning the World Cup?
Incredible.
Incredible, yes. We would guess that. But if we want the exact, okay, we put that into Google search and we put it then, the same question into a ChatGPT or an AI search engine. The ChatGPT or the AI search engine uses 10 times more energy than the Google search. And 340 times more CO2 emissions. Just the same search in the different search engine. So, what is our posture in response to this? Four responses I want to say between these issues that we face with our lurch towards gain and profit. This question, there are these questions that are posed to Coalette. He says, two are better than one because they have a good return for their labour. If either one falls down, one can help the other up. But pity anyone who falls down and has no one to help them up. Also, if two lie down together, they will keep warm. But how can we keep warm alone? Though may one be overpowered, two can defend themselves. A cord of three strands is not quickly broken. So, firstly, as we finish, all our gains, all our advantage, all our profit and surplus, and that is our health, our money, our privileges, our respect, our possessions, our achievements, should exist in mutuality within relationships in community. We should always read and monitor and understand what we gain as being impactful on the world around us and our community. We need our community to share each other the mutuality of each other's gains. So generosity is in part sharing our gains as a gift with others as we receive other people's gains. That is gain in community. And the wisdom is knowing when our personal gains should be tempered or resisted even when they are not for the good of the community. And actually sometimes when our personal gains actually harm the community, whether that is a local community, a workplace, a neighbourhood, or off far off places that are a result of what we buy. Secondly, our posture and an orientation should embrace the innate giftness and givenness of life. We will come back to this because Coalette comes back to it time and time again. Life in all its randomness, often its fruitlessness, is a gift that can't be grasped or seized, but received. And the giftness and the givenness of life should temper our understanding of gain. advantage, surplus. And it is the counter-narrative, both to our internal ledger and our external Fitbit culture. What we gain and what we get as surplus is not a reward, but a gift that we receive humbly. And we receive it graciously. Not a reward for our effort or our efficiency. Thirdly, there is a juxtaposition between being fruitful and being faithful. From being on a journey to getting to a destination. From being and achieving. From staying or moving. From being ordinary and being exceptional. From the present and being now to viewing what will be possible at another time. These are all different but normal, essential experiences of life which should be held in tension. Darcy's already mentioned that this morning. The tension of all these opposites, these things that we experience in various times and seasons. And we are never in any one moment in any given time or season. And wisdom is discerning what season requires what posture, what outlook and what behaviour in relation to our gains and our surplus. And then finally, number four. Ecclesiastes 3 verse 14. I know that everything God does will endure forever. Nothing can be added to it and nothing can be taken from it. God does it so that people will fear him. God, and this is what some of the things that Eleanor has brought already this morning. God inhabits and enlivens our work and reward. Our outputs and our outcomes, our ordinary and our exceptional. And what will ultimately endure out of all these things is in her hands, not in ours. And this goes for the debits and the credits. It goes for the profits and the losses. It goes for the down and the up. God doesn't organise or ordain these things, but inhabits and enlivens them. So ultimately, our gains are not in our hands. We're not in control of what will ultimately endure. And that, frankly, is a good thing. It is a good thing because we cannot control those outcomes and we are called to be and have a different posture. Much of what God does in the world is through us, through the church and through regular, normal humans. And so, therefore, he is intimately involved and invested in the process of being human and therefore is for us in these gains for the good of community and for the good of the planet. And what will endure is bound up in the counter-narrative of the radical kingdom come. And so therefore what will endure may look very different from what we think is a gain or a surplus or indeed a debit or a loss. Only God measures and monitors those things and how long they will last. And that is something that can reassure us when our work is fruitless, when our toil and where our effort is hard to grasp what we have produced. Ultimately, we have got to believe that God will decide what will endure and what won't, what is fruitful and what will produce something in eternity. And that, frankly, without stopping wanting to strive and work, it relieves us of a burden to control our gains and be in charge of our gains, or at least we think we are, when actually we're not. And to understand what ultimately will have lasting value. And you only need to reread the parable of the workers in the vineyard to realise just how radical this kingdom gain and loss actually is. We're going to pray now, and I'm just going to read this prayer and poem as a finishing off of some of the things we've said. I know there's been a lot there as usual, and hopefully some of it may have landed, and the rest you can just bin. So Let's pray, let's use this as our posture as we go into this week, and to think about some of the things that this ancient wisdom has been talking to us about. God of all eternity, we stand beneath the sun with the preacher, counting the fragments of our labour and wondering where the gain has gone. We have built and we have watched it crumble. We have sown and watched another reap. We have poured out strength like water and found our cup still empty. What is this ache, this exhausting circle of effort without profit, of striving without gain? The preacher's cry echoes through our bones, absurdity, a chasing after the wind, a grasping of smoke. The years pass, the work remains unfinished, the ledger does not balance, the sweat dries and still the ground demands more. Lord, we confess our frustration. We are weary of investing where returns never come, weary of carrying burdens that seem to leave no mark upon the earth, weary of giving our best to the days that disappear like breath on a winter air. Why must the righteous toil and the reckless inherit? Why does diligence often stand empty-handed while fortune falls elsewhere? We do not ask these questions from unbelief, but from the honest wound of being human beneath the sun. Yet even here in the shadow of Ecclesiastes, we find a stubborn light. If gain is not the measure, then perhaps you are. If profit is not the treasure, then perhaps your presence is. If our work cannot save us, cannot justify us, cannot guarantee reward, then we are finally free to place our tired hands into yours. Teach us to labour without worshipping the harvest. Teach us to build without making monuments of our achievements. Teach us to plant even where we may never see fruit. For every wind-chasing ambition that dies in our hands drives us towards the one who cannot be lost. And so we pray, when effort seems wasted, be our inheritance. When success evaporates, be our reward. When the numbers fail, when recognition fades, when all our striving proves unable to satisfy the hunger of our soul, let us discover that you remain. The wind cannot be caught. The years cannot be kept. The work will one day end, but you, O God, are not an enigma. You are the permanence that outlasts every unfinished project, every forgotten accomplishment, every frustrated dream. So receive our labour, however small. Receive our weariness, however deep. Receive our unanswered questions, however sharp. And when we stand empty-handed at the end of all our striving, let us find that we are not empty at all, for we are held by the everlasting hands that neither tire nor fail. Amen. Amen.